It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can check out at filmsociology.tumblr.com. Kobe Slagle is out on special assignment. It's just you and me today, but it's a very special show because we're celebrating a mixture of film sociology and, of course, WFYI television. Mystery Science Theater is coming to PBS starting Thursday nights at 9 p.m. on WFYI 1 television. And so it's a great excuse to not only play my recent interview with Mary Jo Peel, who, of course, was one of the writers and played Mrs. Forrester on the series, but also to go back into the archives and reshare my chats with Kevin Murphy of Mystery Science Theater, of course, the voice of Tom Servo, and a member of Riff Tracks, and of course Joel Hodgson, the creator and the character of Joel Robinson. So we'll play those in a little bit, but I do want to get to what's new in theaters quickly. Shameless plug, the play I'm directing, Star on the Door, opens tonight at Scottish Rite Cathedral, 262-3100 for ticket information, curtain at 7:30 tonight and tomorrow night, as well as next Friday and Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m. There's also a 3 p.m. matinee on Saturday the 21st if you want to come see a fun, wacky backstage farce directed by yours truly. So that's part of the reason why. Long story, you can ask me on the street. But opening in theaters today, we have a live-action version of Cinderella done by Disney, starring Lily James as Ella, Kate Blanchett is the stepmother, Helena Bonham Carter is the fairy godmother, don't we wish, and Kenneth Branagh is directing. It's interesting that he's gone from Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, to this, to Thor, and of course, hopefully, I would like him to do another Shakespeare film, if possible. So go see Cinderella so Ken Branagh can make another Shakespeare film. Also out on in theaters is the Academy Award-nominated foreign film Leviathan, which apparently, and I'm reading this, of course, to Nouveau. Thanks, Nouveau. A 140-minute Russian film about a small-town fisherman who tries to take on big-city bureaucracy. So that is at Keystone Arts. And, of course, another action film starring Liam Neeson. This time he is going up against Ed Harris. Common is in this film as well. From the director of Unknown, who worked with Liam in the film Run All Night. So that is happening. No Time for Sergeants is happening this weekend at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin, starring Andy Griffith. That's one for you, Scott Hoke. And at Kobe's alma mater, We have Walter, which is happening tonight at 7:30. Oh, I'm sorry, that's at the IMAX. Sorry. The film Walter, which was talked about last week, and you can see the review in Nuvo. On March 16th at IU Cinema in Bloomington, you have Hard to Be a God. On the 14th, tomorrow at 3 o'clock, Fellini's Satyricon. That's in his, what some would say, overindulgent phase in the late 60s, early 70s. Still fun to watch. And the Visualizing Experimental Science Short Film Program is happening at IU Cinema at 6:30 tonight, and it's free. So good reasons to head down to Bloomington. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, opening in theaters today as well is the comedic mockumentary called What We Do in the Shadows. And this is written and directed and starring the gang that brought us Flight of the Conchords. And it's a documentary about vampires who happen to be flatmates. So take all the vampire cliches that you've heard, and then take all the roommate cliches that you've heard, and mash them up. And that's kind of what you get with this film. You see, of course, four very different characters, because all roommates are different, as well as a newcomer, because he is a newly bitten and loves to brag about being a vampire. But you see these characters going to, as far as chores around the flat, going clubbing, looking for girls, of course, having roommate troubles with each other, dealing with ex-girlfriends, and you kind of get the gist of it. Now, the film is about 80 minutes or so. Is it well-made? Yes. Is it funny? At times, little late to the party, I would think. There was a god-awful film parody called Vampire Suck that came out in 2010. Now, I guess it's not being topical. I guess vampires are sort of universal, but in lieu of Twilight and the other vampire stories that have come out in recent time, just a little late for my taste. And also the fact that I would have liked to have seen maybe a 30-minute version of it, or even a 60-minute version of it, as opposed, so maybe for television as opposed to an 80 minutes or so feature film. So funny, yes. Groundbreaking, no. Dated. For me, sure, but if you're into vampires and you're into dark humor and mockumentary filmmaking, you might enjoy this more than I, and that's okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to get to my chat with writer, comedian Mary Jo Peel. Not only is, of course, she was a member of Cinema Titanic. She, of course, played Mrs. Clayton Forrester in Mystery Science Theater 3000, which starts Thursday nights at 9 on WFYI 1 television. And she has a new project. She's released an EP of fake songs from movies that she watched in Mystery Science Theater. So she created theme songs for these films that she riffed. And the EP is called Songs in the Key of B Movies. And ladies and gentlemen, here is my chat with Mary Jo Peel. So, Mary Jo, tell us about Song in the Key of B Movies.
Well, I was looking for some sort of project to do after Cinematic Titanic stopped touring. And I don't know if you've ever heard or read the book, The Artist's Way.
Yes.
And when you do it, it sort of walks you through the steps of the things you'd like to do in your life. And one thing that came up for me when I did The Artist's Way several years ago was wanting to sing or be in a band or make an album. So I kind of thought, you know, maybe this is what I do. And I just didn't have a framework for it. So I approached a friend of mine who I have worked with for years in the Twin Cities, doing a lot of theater, and he had all these great ideas about how to approach it, and that's how it came to be. Am I answering your question?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Well, that's part of it, because I was going to ask how this started, which you just did. When I first heard that this album was happening, I thought it was that you were singing songs that were already on the film. So my first concern was, why are you doing Arch Hall Jr. tunes?
Right. Well, no, and I really didn't want to do that. I sort of wanted to, you know, use MST3K as informing it, but I also wanted it to be original too. And so when I was talking to Mike about producing it and writing the songs, we were kind of bouncing it around, and then it kind of took shape, like, this should be the imagined theme songs. And he wrote these amazing, funny songs. I mean, he totally got it. So that, and we really couldn't do a lot with any of the movies and the songs that already exist because of licensing. So we did sort of an Imagine theme song take on it.
Well, I'm sure Hoyt Axton is relieved.
Yeah. Yeah, you better watch his back.
What films inspired the songs for the album?
Mike Warren revisited all the movies. I feel like I didn't do too much of that because they're already in my bones. I wanted to do some of my favorites, which would have been Time Chasers and Space Mutiny is one of my favorites. We also felt like we had to do Manos because it's a huge fan favorite, as is Mitchell. So we kind of, and then after looking at the movies, we realized that they were really rich for providing some sort of material for an Imagine theme song. And then I got this wild hair that we should also cover the song that the guy does in, I can't even remember now, Matt. It's a California Lady, and I forget what movie it's from. It's not a theme song. It's when the characters go to a bar. And it's a really perfect California laid-back, lame sort of folk song. And it kind of took on a life of its own within the history of Mystery Science Theater. And I thought, I want to do that. So I spent months trying to track down Frank Larrabee, who's the singer and the writer of the song in the movie, and he finally agreed to let us cover it. So I'm doing a cover of it.
Oh, my gosh. I'm assuming, are there different genres of music in this collection?
Yeah, one is very much sort of a Shirley Bassey homage. A Space Mutiny has a real synth 80s vibe to it.
Of course.
Manos, I guess I'm at a loss to describe that one.
Well, it's hard to describe Manos, period.
I'm sorry?
It's hard to describe Manos, period.
Yeah, well, yes. So, yeah, they're all inspired by sort of the theme song genres.
Getting back to Manos, because, by the way, my daughter's 13, and she thinks that and The Room are the two worst cinematic experiences she's ever had.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
She knows that. Have you always wanted to sing and play an instrument?
Well, yes, I have always wanted to sing. I've always fancied myself being in a rock band. I almost always fancied myself, Stevie Nicks or some such. But I had very little musical training. I'm like a in-the-car singer. So, I was pursuing other things at the time. I never imagined myself actually doing it. And like I say, when I read The Artist's Way and you start writing things that you sort of lost track of, like what were my dreams at one point, it came up again. And I really have no delusions that this is going to be my big Grammy winning album of the year. I really did it for fun. I'm at an age and a point in my life where I want to pursue things with people who are talented and funny and make me laugh and totally get it. And it was working with Mike Warren, and it was doing something I'd never done before.
And even if you do win awards, you still have to give them to Beyonce.
Yeah, I know. If I won something, who knows if Kanye would darken my doorstep.
Yeah, you have to respect her, So with the
owns all.
Yeah. With the recording of these songs, did you go back and watch any of the movies afterwards or to prepare for it?
No, I didn't, because I've seen them all a couple of times. I think over the past couple of years I've revisited all of those movies. So I didn't necessarily prepare for the songs.
Mystery Science Theater is going to be featured on PBS starting in March. Did you ever think your work would be seen on public television? I know you've done NPR essays in the past.
Yes. No. Never imagined. I never imagined 90% of the permutations that Mystery Science Theater has taken.
My daughter, when she was younger, referred to them as daddy movies with the funny robots. So.
That's the new title. That's the new PBS title.
Gee, I wish. But, I mean, she's literally grown up watching your work. And so,
wow.
So help. So despite my Manos thing, thank you for helping raise my child.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
It's cheaper that way. I guess, going back, how did you first become involved with Mystery Science Theater?
I knew those guys from doing stand-up. I knew Mike Nelson. I knew Bridget. I knew Joel from doing stand-up in the Twin Cities in the mid-late 80s. And they started the show, and at the time, I didn't have a television, so I never saw it. I didn't really get what it was about, but I knew it was kind of a deal because, you know, it's a television show produced in our hometown. So after they were going for a couple of years, they got picked up by Comedy Central. It might have been Ha at the time. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that they were expanding the staff. And Bridget called me and she said, "You didn't hear it from me, but we're looking to add someone to the staff, so you might want to give Mike a call, Mike Nelson." So now I've completely outed Bridget 25 years later. And so I called Mike, and I was incredibly nervous. And mind you, I hadn't even seen the show. I didn't even know what I was asking for. I was doing a lot of stand-up comedy, and I just knew I wanted to get off the road. Like, a daily writing gig would be great. So I called him up, and I said, you know, I played it cool, and I said, if you're ever happening to be looking for new writers, I'd be interested. And he started to talk, and at that moment, my dot matrix printer started printing something, so I couldn't, and I had a very tiny apartment, so I couldn't hear what he was saying, but the upshot of it was, he said, well, we are looking for a couple new writers, so I'll give you a call about coming in for an audition. And so I did, and then they forgot I was there, and I stayed for 7 years.
So besides being a voice and besides playing Pearl, how many characters do you think, have you ever jotted down how many characters you have played over the years?
Wow, that's a really good question. I've never counted. It could be 6 or 8.
How did you approach writing for the show? I wondered if you guys broke into teams. I know you watched the films together, but I wondered if there were groups that were broken into as far as working on this segment or, you know, this non-film part of the show.
No, we all took a whole segment. We would brainstorm during the writing of the movie. We were all in a writing room for the writing of the movie. And then for those interstitials, those host segments, we would brainstorm, have a brainstorming session. We'd come up with ideas during the movie, and then we would winnow them down, and we would go individually. We would each be assigned one and work individually on those. Sometimes if we had more people in the writing staff, in the writing room at the time, a couple of people here and there might team up, but that wasn't the norm.
And how much did you write of Pearl?
Oh, you know, it really depended. If I got assigned a particular sketch that involved Pearl, but it was never intentional. It wasn't like I aimed to write all the Pearl sketches. So everybody had a shot at writing Pearl.
So I how was it to go with the evolution? Because, you know, watching it, obviously, to go from what was a supporting character to, well, and that's finger quotes, but to becoming, you know, the head villainess over time. How was it evolving with that character, not only as a writer, but as an actor?
Oh, I don't know, Matt, because I'm not that sophisticated of an actor. So it wasn't like there was any sort of arc or character development. I think we drew her in pretty broad strokes. I think the thing that was challenging for me was having more lines because I don't memorize very well. And at the get-go, I was really nervous about stepping into those shoes and seriously, having to walk and talk at the same time was a real challenge for me. To hit your mark and be saying words and then have some intonation to the words, that was really a struggle. I think the hardest part was the weird sort of backlash about the Pearl character. This was kind of pretty much at the ascendancy of the internet and chat rooms and people being able to voice their opinions in a public forum. And there were a lot of hateful things said, and that I wasn't prepared for. Sadly, I took it a little too much to heart. And then, you know, after a while, I kind of moved on because, you know, you get a perspective on it. I'm just going to do the work. So that was a part that I wasn't prepared for.
I'll call it for you. Basement dwellers is what you call them.
Yes. Still, you know, it's so surprising because you think you're just going to work to do your job, and then people are talking about you and saying really mean things, which I don't understand why you have that much time to labor over these imaginary characters on a silly show.
Well, it's 2015, and there's still Joel Mike debates. So
I know. Don't get me started.
The basements are busy. They're always busy. Do you have a particular episode or a film that comes to mind when people ask about Pearl?
No, because I can never. It's been so long, and there were so many. I can never connect particular host segments to the movies they were specific to. One of my favorites, or one that stands out, is one where Mike floats over to the floating van and we just have a nice chat. And I think there were a lot of funny lines in it. I think, you know, Mike is such a great actor and comedic actor. The Bobo and Brain Guy stuff, at that time we were with the Sci-Fi Channel. So we had to have a different story arc for each movie. And so that was kind of a struggle. I'm not sure it always worked, but working with Bill and Kevin always made me wet my pants from laughter, not just randomly, but laughter.
Thank you for clearing that.
I can't remember what the specific storylines were, but just working with them was a blast.
Well, it sounds like because it was a long time ago, but because you had so many episodes, this could be like your version of the musician who's getting on the tour bus and getting off. And which city are we in? So,
yeah. If it's Tuesday, it must be Cincinnati.
Right, exactly. So you do have the touring lifestyle back when you were working on that.
Yes,
I'm going back to Manos, but apparently that was one of the hardest ones to write for, to prepare.
That was, I'd only been with the show less than a year when we got Manos, and I was still, you know, feeling my way through the writing room dynamics and desperately wanting to not lose that job like I had so many other jobs in my life. And when that started, I remember the distinct energy in the room. Everyone was really just sort of this sort of silent, breathless WTF about that movie, because it's so strange. Nothing happens in the first 20 minutes. We had no idea what we had gotten ourselves into.
Well, the first 20 minutes apparently was a travelogue for The Fair City.
Yeah, I know. I know. And the history of that movie is so bizarre and weird that it's, I think there's some, like the guy was a cement salesman or a fertilizer salesman or something, and swore to a filmmaker, a Hollywood filmmaker was in town, and that the Manos filmmaker swore to him that he could make a better movie than any Hollywood direct, and that's what he came up with.
The problem was he picked Hollywood, Texas, I think. Do you remember the first fun bad movie experience you had? I mean, not as a member of Mystery Science Theater, but as a regular person.
Yeah, I remember going to the drive-in with a bunch of high school friends. We were all this group of nerds, and we went to see Piranha at the drive-in, and I loved it. It sort of, the light bulb kind of went off, like, wow, really? Does anyone know how bad this is? So it sort of shifted my thinking in terms of, oh, not every movie that gets made is good, because I think until that point I'd been kind of naive that since it had been made, it must be good. And then I saw Piranha and I thought, oh, no, that doesn't always work. And we, oh, man, we laughed. We loved it so bad.
And that was written by John Sayles, too.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was one of his early jobs.
I had forgotten that. No way. Oh, no.
Well, you know, it's not often you get Piranha and Eight Men Out in your resume at the same time.
Exactly.
You got to start somewhere, I suppose. I say, how often did you go to the drive-in as a kid?
Oh, I can't imagine very, very often. I mean, that's when they actually existed. That's when they were pretty routinely attended. Not like now where you can't find them. They don't really exist.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, my chat with the very funny Mary Jo Peel. For more information, you can go to mjpeel.com. Let me go through that again. mjpeel.com. Get more information on Mary Jo as well as songs in the key of B movies. Now, a while back, I got to talk with Kevin Murphy as a member of Riff Tracks, because you didn't get enough information about me talking or me asking about Manos, the Hands of Fate. But I got to talk a little bit more about Manos with Kevin Murphy about, and this was a while back. So this event already happened. So don't plan mark your calendars around this. But here is my chat with Kevin Murphy. Joining me on Film Sociology is a man whose work is now part of the Soci household. Just so you know, Kevin, we in my house we say things like, oh, do you dare, and movie bad, movie go away. Kevin Murphy of Riff Tracks, how are you?
I am just fine, Matt. How are you?
Doing great.
Good.
Now, like I said, my daughter is 10. She's the kids' film correspondent, and she wanted me to tell you she cannot decide which film is worse, the worst film that she's ever watched, Manos or The Room?
Ooh.
So thank you for that.
Oh, you're most welcome. And yeah, I would put Manos up there or down there below The Room, only because you can actually see and hear all of The Room.
Well, if as much as you can understand Tommy Wiseau.
That's true.
So for those who don't know, tell us about Manos, The Hands of Fate, the greatest movie ever shot in El Paso.
That's for sure. And as far as I know, you know, there's a lot of legends running around, but essentially it was originally made by a fertilizer salesman from El Paso who sort of did it on a bet, saying that he could actually make a film. And he did, having absolutely no experience or talent at it. And I think he was very proud of the fact that he actually made the film. It didn't make any difference to him whether it was good or bad. And it's a story about a family who is driving and gets lost in the West Texas desert and comes across we're supposed to think eventually that it's like a semi-mythical place where a fellow who looks a little bit like Zach Galifianakis with giant knees lives with a tall fellow who looks like Jeff Foxworthy in a muumuu.
Now, and of course, the parent, especially the dad, makes decisions that even horror movie teenagers say, don't do it.
Yeah, bad choices. He endangers his child constantly. He immediately trusts the evil goat-footed man, and he lets the family dog get killed. I'm sorry, these are spoilers, aren't they?
No, from a 50-year-old film? Right. And you know what? They're also made out of people, so it's okay.
Right, yes.
It's all right. Now, I know if I remember in some interviews, some of the group from MST has referred to this as the worst film you guys ever showed. Is there a list?
I don't know. You know, it was different for different people. And worst is, you know, it is a subjective thing. It wasn't one of the hardest films we went through. It was hard. It was really hard. Maybe it was, but it wasn't the hardest film that we actually had to riff. I always give that over to either The Robot versus the Aztec Mummy, which is, I believe, the only time that we ever pulled out a bottle of tequila to help ourselves through the writing session. Personally, Red Zone Cuba was much more grim and desperate and sad and soul-sucking for me than Manos was. Although my soul was thoroughly sucked out by Manos, Red Zone Cuba was worse for me.
That was the other title I was thinking of in that case. So so now Riff Trax is going to revisit Manos. Why would you do this?
That is an excellent question. Why would Evel Knievel try to jump over the Snake River Canyon twice? Because he's an idiot? Okay, that's what I'm saying. No, it seemed like the appropriate time. You know, next year, Mystery Science Theater will be 25 years old from its very first shows. And it's the film that when we've asked people, what would you like to see us do live, Manos keeps coming back. It just kept coming back. So sort of people were demanding Manos. It's a film that our fans, who were Mystery Science Theater fans, I think it's the one they recall the most because it is so exquisitely painful and bad that for them it sort of sums up what the whole riffing world is about. So it just seemed appropriate. And we've got two young, very funny writers along with Mike, Bill, and I, Sean Thomason and Connor LaStelka. And they're bringing a fresh perspective to this thing. And so we're really taking it back down. I haven't seen the film in truly over 10 years until just in the last couple of months. And so the old wounds had all closed up, and now they're all open again, and except I have a brand-new perspective on it. I think it'll be if you can even say that in regards to Manos, it'll be a fresh take on Manos.
Well, I wondered how much was going to be new material or old. First thing I thought of were rock bands and jazz bands that now tour and perform an entire album in its entirety, and I wasn't sure if you three were going to just do the original riffs from the first time.
No, that'd be too easy. And I think people, you know, when we've done our live show, we did Plan 9 from Outer Space, which was one of our more popular live shows. We rewrote the script for that so that it'd be fresh even from our own riff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not Mystery Science Theater anymore. We're Riff Trax, so we sort of have to do it in our own way. And not perform the album, as it were.
Well, it's funny. We got to see the Plan 9, and it was fun hearing my daughter go, daytime, nighttime, Bella, not Bella.
Oh, fun.
So where are you guys performing the film itself?
We will be at the Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee, which is a great old proscenium sort of theater. It's been a venue for a lot of rock and roll acts as well as a movie theater. And so, you know, it's a little bit frumpy, but it's, you know, it's also has its great charms. It's very intimate. So it's a perfect place for us to do it. And because of that, when we beam it out nationwide to, I think it's about 550 theaters, mm-hmm. Then it keeps that intimacy because it looks like, you know, you're in the theater and you're watching us in this little theater in front of a crowd of just a few hundred people. It just makes it feel, it gives that live experience that much more connection. The audience gets more connection to us because we're really connected to that audience in Nashville.
You mean you couldn't find a theater in El Paso to do this?
You know, always afraid that if we do it in the hometown, that they're going to run us out on a rail.
Well, there is something to be said because also on the show this week, where I was talking about a couple films from the 70s, and it's great to see films that are not in Hollywood or New York. I just watched the 70s zombie film Sugar Hill.
Which
was filmed in Houston, and then you have a film like Blackenstein, which I believe was shot in Louisville, Kentucky.
That would make sense. Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So what are things? What is going on with Riff Trax besides Manos?
Well, we continue to do riffs of big Hollywood films, but we've also been concentrating lately on doing some, you know, cheesy older films, sort of like we used to do on Mystery Science Theater, because again, people have been asking for us to do that. So. Just recently we have a film called Neutron versus the Death Robots, which is a Mexican wrestler hero film.
Yes.
So that's a lot of fun. We're doing films sort of that ilk. We just recently did Future Cop, which features David Carradine with his, you know, big beer gut sleeping his way through the lines. And it's the future, only it's like a 70s version of the 80s, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think of the costumes in Logan's Run.
Right, right. Oh, they're worse here. Yeah, yeah. You know, they just sort of took, you know, for their future-y cars, he drives a Jeep Commando.
Ah, well, of course. Who knew that car was so far in advance?
Nothing changed on it whatsoever, and yet it is future for us.
Now, are you guys able to pick old film, new film? Is there a pattern, or does it just go with how you guys are feeling?
Well, it kind of goes with what is either available or popular, because what we found is that we'll pour our hearts out into a new release that we, you know, just do the MP3 riff for and then send it out there. And nobody's renting it, so there aren't that many copies available. So it makes it sort of silly if we're going to go to all the trouble to riff, you know, a 3.5-hour modern piece of junk that only 10 or 12 people rented. That's not very encouraging. So we've been sticking to really like the prime cuts these days, you know, your Twilights, your superhero action films. So, you know, they're going to get their due.
Yeah, I would say I think your versions of Twilight and The Room are probably some of the best and probably the most popular. Is Tommy Wiseau or Kristen Stewart become the new Joe Don Baker? Are they looking for you?
Haven't heard from Kristen. From what I understand, Tommy is sort of confused by what it is we're doing and thinks somehow we're actually stealing the movie.
Uh-oh.
So we had to disabuse him of that notion, because we're not. We're just helping him along. If anything, we're selling more units of The Room.
And that's what lawyers are for, so they have to listen to him.
Right.
Now, is the viewing time of Riff Tracks similar to Mr. Science Theater? Like, how many times do you watch a film before you actually riff it?
Well, it's a little different from what we used to do at Mystery Science Theater in that we don't do everything out of a writing room. What we do these days is, since there's five of us, we sort of divide the film up into five parts, and we each take a chunk and just sit and look at it for, sometimes a week at a time, depending on the film, because it takes at least an hour of writing time to deliver a minute of script, sometimes more. So you spend a whole lot of time with a chunk of the film, and then when it comes together, I think we've become such a good unit that it's hard to tell one writer from the other. And we come together and we do a revision and we do a rehearsal and then we record it. And by the time we record it, we're so stinkingly familiar with the film that, you know, it's very easy to perform.
And how long do you decompress after a film like that?
Well, unless I have to, except for quality control purposes, I don't really revisit any of these films again for a good long time after I've watched them.
So do you cleanse your palate by watching a good movie?
Whenever I can, you know, that gets harder to do these days. So I go back and, my favorite medicine in the world is Turner Classic Movies.
Good call. Good call. I would say, and your book was a lot of fun, and you made me feel like a slacker, so I'm still trying to pick up on that.
I appreciate it. I'm encouraged. What I've heard recently, people who have followed me because of my book on either Facebook or Twitter have been tweeting me back that a lot of outdoor theaters and drive-in theaters are opening again. It's becoming another a trend again, except they're having better food and the sound is better and they're making more of an event out of it in some places. So it's not sort of like the sleazy old place you remember. It's just, you know, it's gotten a little bit classier. I don't know how to feel about that, but I still love going to a drive-in and seeing a movie.
Absolutely. There's I think, one in Indiana still. But, I think of the architectural theaters that were gloriously downtown venues, and then they turned into porn houses in the 60s and 70s, and now they're trying to revitalize downtowns.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's one way to do it. It's, people will never stop going to the movies, and as long as they can make some money, I'm a big supporter of single-screen theaters that show whatever it is they think they should show, be that a repertoire or just things that they handpick that they're not forced down them by the distributors. You know, I encourage that.
Absolutely. And we also have an unnamed art house chain here in Indy, and they did midnight movies this summer, and they're doing it again in the fall, including The Room and Troll 2.
Wonderful.
So, hey, so how often do you get to watch movies at home with the family on your own?
We do it quite often, actually, thanks to things like Netflix and Vudu and such outlets. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And then, of course, Turner Classic Movies, which is one of those destinations I go to. I will flick it on. I'll see something that maybe I've never seen before, and I'll find myself up until 2 in the morning watching something from, you know, 1936 or a silent series or something like that.
Or non Frankie and Annette beach movies.
Right. Oh, yes. Dear Lord.
Now, do you, I mean, I'm not saying you riff at home, but do you mutter and just out of habit?
Only if something's really bad. And then, yeah, my governor goes off and I peg the needle and I fly off the handle. And then usually Jane, my spouse, says, oh, let's change the channel. Or let's go play Scrabble. Or let's do something besides listen to you tear into something I like.
Can you give us an example of a film recently?
Oh, it's, you know, I actually am more inclined to do this with things like House Hunters.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, do you – oh, so go ahead.
Oh, no, and Jane's tastes trend more towards, you know, chick films.
Okay.
So if it's something sort of a goopy chick film on there, I'll start getting snide, and then she'll smack me down.
We kind of do that with Food Network and HGTV.
It's so easy.
Yeah, and anytime you can make House Hunters seem like gambling in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you remember the first film? I mean, I'm talking about way before Mystery Science Theater, that you ever riffed in a theater or started to think about snide comments as a kid or even as a young adult?
Actually, the first time I felt I found myself actually in a theater making fun of a film, my brother Christopher and I think it was, went to see this really bad film with Marlon Brando and George C. Scott called The Formula.
Yes, yeah.
It was supposed to be this big pot boiler, and we were about halfway through, and yeah, we started just riffing on the film with each other. And it was a, you know, like a midweek thing. I think we were both working in restaurants, and so we had the days off, and went to see this film in a theater, and there was nobody else there, so it was perfect.
I just found that for $2 at a bookstore, so you could watch. Yep. So you could watch Marlon Brando with an earpiece.
That's right.
Because there was that, and there was, if you remember, Reflections in a Golden Eye that he did with Elizabeth Taylor and a naked,
oh my, yes,
naked Robert Forrester, which Mrs. Forrester didn't even ask for. So do you guys have Christmas and Halloween all planned out for Riff Tracks?
We do not. I know it's been announced that sometime around Halloween. I don't have the dates with me. You might want to check with the Riff Tracks people, you know, the guys who actually know stuff.
Yeah.
That we are going to Riff Birdemic, Shock and Terror.
Wow. Nationwide. Of course.
For Fathom Entertainment.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So
that'll be a lot of fun.
And people can go to Riff Tracks website and check that out.
Go to rifftracks.com and check it out.
Are you on Twitter or are you just on Facebook?
I'm mainly on Twitter. Facebook gives me hives.
I'm sorry to hear that. Like Manos hives?
Hives, yes, yes. I love the Twitter because it makes me keep it short, and I'm much better when I'm doing short stuff instead of prattling on.
No political diatribes? No.
No. I stay away from the politics. No, I make jokes about, you know, my love of meat. I think that's about as political as I get. Is that I said I'd be a vegetarian as long as I could first eat all the ducks in the world.
Wow, there's some right-wing vegans that are going to come after you. It's like the punk band we have here in Indianapolis, Gay Black Republican.
Oh, that's beautiful.
My classic chat with Kevin Murphy is to celebrate the PBS premiere of Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is starting Thursday night, March 19th at 9 p.m. on WFYI 1 television. Last year, I got to chat with Joel Hodgson, who was at one of the conventions here in town last summer, to talk about his one-man show. But, of course, I got to ask him a little bit about the early incarnations of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Ladies and gentlemen, my chat with Joel Hodgson. Tell us a little bit about riffing myself, because I know you'll be riffing yourself at Indie PopCon.
Yes. There's two versions of riffing myself. There's the public riffing myself, which is at 5:30 on Friday, and that's May 30th. Oh, wait. Yeah, 5:30. And then I do behind riffing myself, which is a more in-depth VIP event at 3 p.m. on Saturday. So in riffing myself, it's basically the creation story of Mystery Science Theater, all the influences, all the things I saw growing up, and all the, you know, everything from the music I was listening to the books I was reading, and it's lots of pictures. So yeah.
So how long have you been preparing this one man show? And you have two versions of it.
Oh man, you know, I did it. It probably took me 3-4 months to put together, and then the last year I've been traveling with it. I've probably done 12 or 14 cities and performed it all over the place. So, yeah, something like that.
So how has it changed from the first time you did it in front of an audience?
Well, you learn how to, you know, it's funny, it's like anything. You learn how to lean into certain things. You learn what are the things they really like, what are the things they really want to hear, what are the things that are important to say but they don't really care about, that kind of lead up to the more important things. So it's all kind of an act of massaging all those elements so it flows and it feels like a show, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like you just work, you know. Always the live audience is kind of your best collaborator for making stuff.
I always thought of Mystery Science Theater as kind of a television version of jazz, and I think in this case you're getting to do a solo performance.
I like that. Well, that's a really nice thing to say. I appreciate that. And, you know, the act of riffing comes from, you know, the name comes from a jazz riff, you know, the idea of, you know, reacting to something and being, you know, kind of in the moment. So yeah, it's really, I really like that analogy. It's kind of like that again, you know, with riffing myself, it's really a story. So it's me presenting it with lots of pictures. And I do, obviously, once I put up the pictures, I riff on them, but it's a little different. It's not me riffing on a movie by myself.
Right. Yeah, because with Mystery Science Theater, you know, the movie is different, the riffs are different, the audience reaction is different, whether, you know, we're watching at home. You know, you always hear people say, you know, some episodes are better than others. And I'm sure from your point of view, some riffing myself were better than others, depending on certain cities.
Oh, it's really true. You know, there's so many variables at work. I mean, it's the audience, it's the way I feel well, and you know, and then the thing that's beyond that is just what's happening together with everybody in the room, you know. So it's really true. You can't know, and that's why people like it. And I think that's why people get addicted to performing, is it's never the same, you know. You can tweak it and you can work on it and kind of affect the outcome, hopefully make it better each time and make it flow better each time. But yeah.
Now, you said there's a VIP version of this. Can you give us a little insight on how that is going to differ? I mean, you said more in-depth, more anecdotes maybe, stuff that's
Well, yeah. I mean, mostly it's a lot of – it's kind of – you know, it's really has an open structure where people can stop me at any time and ask questions. And that isn't the case when I do it, you know, the other more public version. That's really a performance. And so the VIP version is, oh, wait, I want to hear more about this, stop, you know. They can raise their hand and stop me and kind of go deeper, you know. It's more interactive, I think.
And I guess you've been riffed already?
Well, you mean people riffing? You mean people like, I think, are you thinking of like hecklers?
Not necessarily heckler. I think even on the street, how often do you get people yelling quotes at you, yelling riffs at you?
Oh, that doesn't happen too much. I mean, you know, it's funny. I feel like it was really peculiar, but right after the show, you know, it's been a long time since the show's been on. It's been 15 years. And I think while the show was on, I think people would get in that headspace and believe that, like, I was the guy. Like, that's me.
Right.
And I'm not like a guy who has, there's like 8 writers in the room and we're all creating stuff. You know, they think Joel's the embodiment of that. And so I think that happened a lot more in the past. People now, I think everybody's kind of settled into what it is and knows what it is. And because I do events like Indie Pop Con, you know, I people have access to me so they can kind of meet me. So it doesn't happen that much as you'd think. I think, also we produce so much material, you know, like 700, 800 riffs per movie, that a lot of times it's possible they're saying stuff and I just don't recognize it. I don't remember it. So that maybe that's it. Maybe they're doing that, but I'm not getting it.
Right. I think it's almost like Shakespeare as far as introducing new things to as far as everyday speak. I mean, I still say occasionally to come up to people and ask them, any of you do Pez?
Oh, that's funny. I think so. You know, I have to say it's so embedded in me. I'll give you an example. I just watched the Mystery Science Theater riff on Sinbad. And or the final voyage of Sinbad or whatever it was. I don't remember. But I did a show with Cinematic Titanic, and I had the guy, there's a character who's sitting alone, and I had him sing Where Is Love from the musical Oliver.
Yeah.
And people laughed really hard, and they loved it. But I didn't realize it was a riff from Mystery Science Theater. I'd done the same joke 15 years earlier, 20 years earlier, and didn't realize it. So it's kind of like, it's so kind of, because when you're writing the show, it's a show about everything. And so you put everything in and you kind of don't know when the show stops and you begin or end. You know, it's kind of like it's all in there. There's just stuff, stuff from just peculiar things from that just happen, you know, the conversations. Like a lot of it is us kind of mimicking the look on somebody's face. And that just comes from conversations you've heard people have or people have said to you. So it's all embedded in that show. And so I have to say, you know, like I said, I don't really know exactly when that happens, where I stop and when the show starts. It's weird.
My daughter is 12. And when she was younger, she referred to it as the daddy movies with the funny robots.
And
now the way I get her out of bed is I will get right into her ear and start to vocalize the theme from Manos, which she said is the worst thing she's ever experienced.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's so great. I have to say, you know, there's moments when it's just, I'm having so much fun because I'm going back and watching them. And it's like there was one that just made me laugh out loud. Completely forgot about it since Sinbad, and this movie is great, and it's got all this energy to it. It's just a huge production, but there's this great big feast they're having with jesters and tumblers and kings, and it's just packed. It's dense, and Sinbad says, "I've been all around the world, and this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen." And it, as simple as that is, it just cracked me up. I laughed out loud at it, and it's really funny. So I'm starting to understand what it's like for people on the outside of it, you know, like what it feels like watching it for the first time, because so much time has gone by.
With the box set, I know you're often on there doing intros and doing the documentaries. How long a stretch do they film those, or how many sessions do you have to go and be filmed for the collections?
They only do it one at a time, usually, or sometimes they'll do pickups and go, oh, we planned far enough in advance where we're going to have you do a section for the next box set. But usually the box sets are recorded one at a time. They're not in series.
Okay. If somebody were to start watching Mystery Science Theater, is there an episode that you would say this is 101?
Oh, you know, I'm really not the guy to do that.
Okay.
I feel like the way I look at them is so different because I'm like the puppeteer, you know, so it's like I don't really get, like, I can't really get that great impression. I know, you know, based on, I've surveyed people on my Twitter feed and asked them, like when we did Turkey Day last year, I asked them their favorite movies. Some of them that keep coming up are things like Mitchell. People love Mitchell. They love Werewolf. I'm going to try to think. They say people like Pod People really a lot. I'm trying to remember the other one. Something in Space. It's a Mike episode.
When going through the library, because we hear the story of the films that are in the library, you know, as far as the video collection, was there ever a film that was known or semi-known, but it just wasn't show material?
Well, we didn't want to do Plan 9. I remember that because that was famous for being a bad movie. And so, you know, we kind of felt that was too on the, you know, we felt like somebody had already found that movie and called it out and said, this is like a terrible movie. This is the worst movie ever made. So that was one that we deliberately didn't do. But other movies that we found, once we found a movie that would work, we felt would work, we really wanted it. We worked really hard to get them. So we didn't like survey movies that we couldn't get. It wasn't like we went on Netflix and looked for movies and said, oh, can we get this one? You know,
right.
Like they had been screened by lawyers in New York, and we got boxes of VHSs that had been, they knew that they could get the rights to, or that it was likely.
I still have a paperback copy of the Golden Turkey Awards, and I would always look for titles, especially with you guys. If I remember, like, Creeping Terror or other films that I've always read about but never got a chance to see, and you guys put a lot of check marks in that book for me, so thank you.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, the Turkey Awards was really influential. I saw that when I was in college, you know, probably like 1981, and that had a huge influence on me. That's actually something I talk about in Riffing Myself, where I go, why isn't anybody making a show with these movies? You know, that was basically the moment where I realized, oh, yeah, like, well, I don't get these, you know, these things are hugely entertaining. Why isn't someone exploiting that? So, yeah, that book looms really large in the story.
Who was your local horror show host? Did you watch that growing up?
Yeah, there was a show out of Madison called, I grew up in Wisconsin, so there's a show in Madison called Ferdy's Inferno. There was a show in Milwaukee called Nightmare Theater. And there was like a really weird character named Toulouse Noneck. He was like a headless guy. That was one of the characters. And then in Green Bay, it was a show called Erie Street, and the host's name was Alexander. He was a vampire.
Shifting gears a little bit, what films, new or old, it doesn't matter, but what films do you like to watch leisurely at home where you don't have to riff?
Oh, man, I'm like everybody. I like want, every time I watch a movie for entertainment, I want to be taken away by it. I want to watch it and enjoy it and like, I watched the Captain America movie. I really liked it, The Winter Soldier. I thought it was really good, and it did just exactly what I was hoping it would. Just kind of, I forget, I cease to be myself, and I'm Captain America, you know.
Do you get recognized in theaters often?
You mean by the shape of my head?
I didn't say that, but...
you know what? That's only happened once, and it was really funny. It was at the place where CineFamily has their residency now in L.A. It was the Silent Movie Theater, and that was the first time and only time I was ever recognized by the back of my head. Somebody who sat behind me tapped me on the shoulder and said, are you the guy from MSC? So, yeah. But it doesn't happen too much. I think occasionally people will pick me out, but I really praise them for being especially gifted and having a good eye. Mm-hmm. I happen to be one of those people. I have really good facial pattern recognition, and so when I used to live in L.A., I'd be able to pick out celebrities all the time, and people with me just wouldn't see them. Mm-hmm. So there are people that are gifted at that, but it's not very often.
Now, I read in the Wired article there was something that was alluded to, that there's going to be some form of reunion, reboot. Can you elaborate on that?
I can't really. That was a leak a little early, so I can't really say anything about it now.
That was worth a shot.
Yeah.
My chat with Joel Hodgson. Just a reminder, folks, Mystery Science Theater 3000, they're old episodes, but they're still timeless and fun. You can start watching Mystery Science Theater 3000 Thursday nights on WFYI 1 television starting at 9 p.m. I want to end tonight's film sociology with music from the Rolling Stones. The song Gimme Shelter is a way of paying tribute to filmmaker Albert Mazels, who died on March 5th at the age of 88, best known for such documentaries as Orson Welles in Spain, Meet Marlon Brando, Salesman, of course, the Rolling Stones documentary Gimme Shelter, Grey Gardens, that one's for you, Melissa Davis, Muhammad and Larry, The Beatles, The First U.S. Visit. He also did Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, Rufus Wainwright, Milwaukee at Last. Also, Photograph, Monterey Pop for D.A. Pennebaker, and much, much more. So, Albert, thank you so much for all of your work. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Go watch Mystery Science Theater 3000 on WFYI, because you can now. Isn't that great? You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good night, Michigan.